Good morning and welcome to Her Turn, a program of news and information from a feminist perspective. I'm Christina Kivlin. The first half of today's program will be an interview related to the Waging Peace in Vietnam event beginning this week at the Wisconsin Historical Society. This will be followed by a discussion about the attacks on the legality of abortion drug mifepristone led by anti-choice activists. We will be talking with the Director of National Strategy on Abortion Rights, Layla Abel-Falzi. Stay tuned for this on the Sunday, March 31st, 2024 edition of Her Turn. Beginning on Tuesday evening, the Wisconsin Historical Society is launching a three-week series of events titled Waging Peace in Vietnam, U.S. Soldiers and Veterans Who Opposed the War. Susan Schnall, who was active in the GI anti-war movement and is currently president of Veterans for Peace, will be speaking as part of the opening event on Tuesday, Soldiers in Revolt, at the Wisconsin Historical Society Auditorium. Schnall spoke this morning with Her Turn's Joanne Powers.
Waging Peace in Vietnam is a project, a photo exhibit, and a narrative that has been going around the country to various colleges and universities, as well as Ho Chi Minh City to the War Remnants Museum, to talk about the GI and veteran anti-war movement that was so active in the 1960s as a protest and as an expression of individual members of the armed forces of disagreement with the current government about the waging war in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. It was an opportunity and a really important voice that we felt the American people had to hear, and that was of ordinary soldiers who said, our government that is waging this war in Southeast Asia is wrong, the troops need to be pulled out, and we need to come to a peace agreement.
And that is the subject of the Soldiers in Revolt event that you're doing on Tuesday.
There are a number of us who will be speaking about our experiences and our activities against the United States military and the government's actions 8,000 miles from the United States.
What is your personal experience with the war and with turning against it?
I was a nurse. I joined the United States Navy to take care of those who were wounded in war and make them what I thought would be whole again, both physically and emotionally, to be able to go back to their communities and their families and live the rest of their lives in peace. And I soon learned that, in fact, that was not my role, that as a nurse in the United States Navy, yes, my role was to get them well again so they could go back into battle and they could fight again and they could continue this war so many miles away. I knew and I felt when I joined the military that I was against war and against armed fighting. But I also felt again that I would be doing something positive for these primarily young men. And what I found out when I joined the military is that now I would become part of the military machine, that I was part of that instrument that allowed the government to continue the fight so many miles away. And I thought I needed to do something about this. I needed to have my voice heard to be able to say to the American public, I'm against this war, I'm against this fighting. And I felt that as a member of the armed services, I would be heard. I joined in late fall 1968 an organization called GI and Veterans March for Peace. I was working at Oak Knoll Naval Hospital in Oakland, California, where we took care of the active duty GIs who returned from war. And we put flyers together. We put posters up all over the hospital. They were torn down. So our voices certainly were not being heard. And I had heard about the United States military dropping flyers, leaflets on the Vietnamese in South and Central Vietnam that urged them to go to these so-called protective hamlets to avoid being sprayed by Agent Orange dioxin that the United States was using to destroy the crops in Vietnam, to devastate the land, to destroy the woodlands, also to avoid the bombing by the United States. And I thought, well, if the United States could do this, drop flyers on this land so many thousand miles away, why couldn't we, who were in the military in the United States, drop peace flyers on military installations in the Bay Area? I had a friend who was a pilot, and we loaded up this one-engine paper club with thousands and thousands of flyers that were announcing the GI and Veterans March for Peace in the San Francisco Bay Area on October 12th. And we dropped the flyers on October 10th over 5 military installations in the Bay Area. We dropped them on Oak Knoll Naval Hospital, on Treasure Island, on Yerba Buena Island, on the Presidio, which was an Army base in San Francisco. And then we flew into Alameda Naval Air Station and dropped the flyers on a U.S. aircraft carrier, and then held a press conference after that where I wore my uniform and said, yes, we are active duty GIs and we are against the United States war on Southeast Asia. And then 2 days later, we had a GI and Veterans March for Peace in San Francisco. And I wore my uniform and spoke out against the war. For that, I faced, it was an Article 15 for disobeying a general naval regulation for wearing my uniform publicly to talk about political issues and for harming the morale of those GIs in active duty who saw the flyers. My defense was, well, if General Westmoreland can go before the United States Congress and request more troops and more armaments for war and for killing and for harming people, then why can't I, as an active duty person in the military, speak against this war and speak for peace? I was tried by general court-martial a couple of months later and found guilty of both charges. The prosecuting attorney wanted 5 years at hard labor for my two terrible, terrible offenses.
Obviously, this is a huge topic, but if you can just very briefly tell me about the enormous costs of war, both for American soldiers, but also for those in Southeast Asia.
Part of the cost that was so horrendous was that we taught these young people to hate people who look different from them and to use slurs about the Vietnamese people and to look at them as disposable, that they had the right to kill and to destroy this land and this people. We think there's about 3 million Vietnamese who died during the American intervention overseas. We had about 2.5 million American troops on the ground until the United States turned the war into an air war, because they realized that for those who had boots on the ground and learned more and more about the war, they became more anti-war. So the war changed as those involved in the military became more anti-military and anti-war in Vietnam. But Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia suffered millions of lives lost. But in addition, during the war, we dropped so much Agent Orange dioxin and Agent Blue and Agent Purple to destroy the forest land, the mangrove forest, and the food supply, that that war on Vietnam continues. There are parts of the land where food no longer grows. We have dropped so much ordnance and bombs and cluster bombs that didn't detonate when they landed on the land and remain on that land, particularly in a province called Quang Tri, that when farmers go to plow the land or children are playing in the land, those explosives go off even today and continue to maim and kill. So the war didn't stop just because there was a treaty signed. The remnants of that war continue. That's what happens in war. that it doesn't just end when the troops leave. Today, we're facing another multiple wars all over the world. Most clearly, I think about Aaron Bushnell, the young 25-year-old airman who immolated himself in front of the Israeli military because he felt he was a part of that war, even though he didn't go overseas, that he enabled the war to continue. It is so important for people to understand that what you do to continue that war, to our executive branch that continues to go around Congress to fund what I would call genocide against the people who live in Gaza, is a continuation of the United States involvement with 850 military bases all over the world. We continue to fund our military. We continue to fund these wars that continue instead of sitting down and negotiating a peace and saying, stop, we're not going to do that. I feel a responsibility to those who continue to get harmed by our government and our military, and that it's time that we all stood up and say, stop this war against people. Be for peace. Be for negotiation. Understand that the only industry that makes a profit out of war is the military-industrial complex, against which President Eisenhower warned us. They are the profit makers. They want these wars to continue. They want to continue making money off this terrible destruction of life on the planet, of all living things.
That was Susan Schnall of Veterans for Peace. She will be speaking at 5 p.m. Tuesday evening as part of Soldiers in Revolt, the panel and opening reception of the Waging Peace in Vietnam exhibition at the Wisconsin Historical Society. The exhibit continues until the 22nd and will be accompanied by several programs promoting health, healing, and reconciliation, including films, concerts, talks, and panel discussions. For the full schedule of events, visit WagingPeaceInVietnam.com. Hello, and I want to welcome Layla Abel Falsley, the Director of National Abortion Strategy at the National Women's Law Center. She works on a range of issues involving the protection and expansion of reproductive rights at the federal level. Thank you, Layla, so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Hello.
Hello. So, essentially, the case about mifepristone is the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine versus the FDA. So what are some of the arguments on mifepristone that have been brought by the Alliance, and do they hold any water?
I will give the TLDR is no, they hold no water. And this is a case made out of thin air based on either studies that have since been retracted or other flimsy evidence that flies in the face of direct evidence of the more than 5 million people who've used mifepristone since the early 2000s. And so what this case is about is several doctors have said that they are harmed when women show up to the ER after using mifepristone for medication abortion, when they have to provide follow-up care to those patients. And so they have asked a court to force the FDA to withdraw approval of that drug that was approved nearly 25 years ago. That was the original claim. And they said that mifepristone was dangerous, it hurt women. The FDA ignored evidence of this and really relied on junk science to make those claims. Now, notably, they incorporated their business entity, the AHM, Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, in a place where they knew they would get a single judge as the judge on their case, Judge Kaczmarek. Judge Kaczmarek has a long record of very openly opposing abortion and other issues, and he gave them what they wanted. He issued an order to revoke FDA approval, and that has spawned a very a year of turmoil when it comes to mifepristone. And so that's the case the Supreme Court heard this week. Although notably, they heard the appeal of a Fifth Circuit decision that did something differently than the judge.
Oh man. So is the Alliance a genuine grassroots organization, or are they just an astroturfed group, more like the Alliance of Hypocritical Medicine?
I think that works here. You know, what was interesting is in Tuesday's oral arguments, there were a lot of questions of whether or not this group had enough claim that they had standing, meaning that they were persons who could bring this case to the courts. And notably, none of the doctors submitted affidavits about, you know, their position, and hadn't really been able to talk about an instance where they had to provide care. One said, I know a friend doctor, colleague doctor, who had to do it. Yes, in a sense, this is, again, it's a made out of thin air case. And if you go to the core of it, it's also incredibly runs in the face of what you think an ER doctor is supposed to do. They take their patients as they are, and as a sense that a doctor is harmed because a patient needs their help, it is really astounding that they're saying they're harmed because they have to provide care to their patients, when that is the raison d'etre of an emergency room in the first place.
Mm-hmm. So they're not actually stating that, you know, they know of someone or they themselves were actually harmed by mifepristone. And it seems like a lot of their arguments happen to be hypothetical situations, especially when you said that they claimed, oh, I have a friend, or I know of another doctor who was put in this situation. But that doctor is also not the one that's bringing this case to the Supreme Court. Is that correct?
Yeah, what they say, and I should make clear that the way the case is pending right now because of what the Fifth Circuit did, is the question now is, can you force the FDA to reimpose medically unnecessary restrictions on medication abortion, restrictions that have been lifted in 2016 and 2021 that make mifepristone more accessible to patients in rural areas, patients who rather access telemedicine. And so they want to reimpose all these restrictions to take all of that away. And really what they argue incorrectly is that those restrictions made people safer. They again cite to Flimsy and junk science to make their case. But really, this is not about mifepristone or medication abortion. This is about abortion. And at the center of their gravity is that abortion is dangerous. The data flies is directly contradictory to that millions have used it successfully. At the root, this is about the national effort to take away abortion from all of us, because the important point here is, if they are successful in their claims, if they are successful and the FDA has to reimpose restrictions, that has nationwide impact, not just impact on states that currently ban or severely limit abortion. And that's their goal here. We have data that mifepristone and medication abortion now make up more than 60% of the abortions that are recorded. And so they know that that's why they are focusing here on their with their fake arguments and flimsy claims, going to judges with clear bias against abortion, because this is all part of their agenda of taking away legal access to abortion for all of us.
And I know some of their arguments or some of the things that they brought up is the Comstock law. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Like, is this even any standing? Like, why are they attacking, you know, medication through the mail?
That's a very good question. And so the Comstock Act is a very old law, 150-year-old zombie act, truly a dead law that the anti-abortion people are now trying to resuscitate in a desperate attempt to, again, take away the most popular form of abortion care in the U.S. that would dramatically impact all of us, no matter where you live. The Comstock Act is named after a man in New York who devoted his life to attacking providers of abortion care, and really went after people who wanted to make their own destinies. Like, this is all part of this effort that women were getting more freedom in this time of the late 1850s, 1860s, and he was there to shut that down. And so, again, this is a much bigger point about women deciding for themselves when to be pregnant and deciding their own destinies and future. And Comstock really represents the antithesis to that. And so this law, a dead law, the anti-abortion movement wants to use it to really cripple medication abortion, and really abortion more broadly, because the arguments they are asserting is that there can be no mailing of abortion supplies, basically. This is an incorrect reading. The Department of Justice of the Biden administration has already issued a memo about how Comstock does not apply to mailing for legal abortion. And so this, again, though, is what they are focusing on and why it came up on Tuesday, because they are desperately clinging to anything. And the truth is, a future administration that is anti-abortion could make lives very miserable in over-resuscitating the Comstock Act and making it impossible to mail many items related to abortion care.
Including, say, birth control and such, which a lot of people seem to get through the mail.
That's a very good point, and it's really important to be clear that it should not bring in birth control, because birth control does not terminate pregnancies. And yet, and there's been some really good coverage of this, anti-abortion people think some forms of birth control are abortion. And so, for example, emergency contraception, which prevents implantation of pregnancy, some IUDs, and this is the center of a case from a decade ago, the Hobby Lobby case, where Justice Alito basically said, look, that case was about birth control methods that Hobby Lobby, a for-profit company, thought was abortion, and that's why they didn't want to cover it. And so what happened there is Justice Alito said, it doesn't matter if science says that's birth control, they believe it's abortion, and so it's banned, or we're not going to require coverage of it. And so your question is a good one, and not in a bad an administration that opposes abortion and forms of birth control it considers abortion, even though the science says it is not, could implicate forms of birth control as well.
Okay. So Justice Barrett had asked specific medical questions about the need for an ultrasound, and also wanting to know how to diagnose an ectopic pregnancy against mifepristone. Should the justices be getting to this level of specificity on health issues?
That is a good question. It's a question of who are the experts and where should deference come into play. And there has been in the Supreme Court not deference to the experts, and there is a broader effort to basically decenter medical and scientific experts. We saw it with the COVID-19 vaccine, and we see it ongoing with other type of vaccines. And so it is not rather what her questions were, but are they looking at the reams of data that have been submitted by the scientists and the data experts? Or, as Judge Kaczmarek did and the Fifth Circuit did, are they ignoring those reams of data to just focus on what the anti-abortion people point to, including retracted studies and blogs that have no backup, that they're based in evidence, to make their decisions? And that is where, if they listen to the providers, the healthcare providers who's filed in support of mifepristone, would explain all of those issues. And it's a question of whether or not they are willing to rely on science and medicine, or if they're going to reject it in advance of this junk science.
So we've got about 2.5 minutes. I just wanted to ask you one final question. So what are some of the issues with the judges parsing the medical and scientific studies?
Well, it goes to the question you had before about what is the role of judges and justices. And this is happening more broadly. If you look to the Supreme Court's Justice Alito's decision in the Dobbs case overturning the constitutional right to abortion, or the case relating to measures to control guns, they are now suggesting that the cases where you are restricting what they say, you know, interpreting the Constitution, you have to go way back in history only and look at what the history is and to understand what those constitutional protections mean. And so Alito said he looked at the Constitution, he looked at the history, historians of the 1850s and 60s, and decided what the 14th Amendment meant. And the 14th Amendment is where, for nearly 50 years, the right to abortion was rooted. And so it actually has to do with what has come clear is that he got it wrong on the history. Since then, historians have been writing about how the history is wrong. But are you pursuing data to prove a point you had already reached before you even did your research? And I think that's a question of, are these judges and justices giving fair shots or not to the plaintiffs or the litigants in the case?
Yeah.
And that is what we have demanded of our judiciary. That is what we expect from our judiciary, an impartial, unbiased judiciary, to look at all the evidence, look in and decide.
Yeah.
And that is what it seems is not very much happening.
Yep. So again, this is Layla Abel-Fosley with the National Women's Law Center. I want to thank you so much for joining us. And we also will be hearing the final results of this case sometime this summer. So thank you again for joining us, Layla.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Have a good rest of the weekend.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Today's edition of Her Turn was produced by Arlene Zoucha, Joanne Powers, and Christina Kivlin. Joanne Powers is also our on-air engineer. Now stay tuned for 2.5 hours of Women in Music on Her Infinite Variety with host Danny Borkon Rutter. For Her Turn, I'm Christina Kivlin. Have a fierce day.